Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tim Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures up again today after the big rally yesterday on the, I don't know, alleged end of the war, but I don't know when that's going to happen. S&P futures up 47, NASDAQ futures up 229. We had yet another bounce in the market yesterday that seemed to happen before any kind of an announcement came out, which is always interesting lately. Anyway, it's someday maybe somebody will look into it, but I guess we won't now. But anyway, the market is up, so that's good, and if the war is over, that would be good as well. Oil is down. It's under down $1.59, so it's trading 99.79. So it's down some, but not huge, but it is down. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
Scraping by.
That doesn't sound overly optimistic. So you didn't get the call? You weren't long spoo yesterday?
No, I definitely was not.
Well, you know, it would have been nice if you were long spoo. Anyway, the other news today, not much. I did... Last night, it's not in any of the headlines this morning, but evidently Trump signed an executive order saying if anybody's going to use a paper ballot, they got to be cleared by ICE yesterday. I'm not so sure what that's all about, but it's kind of interesting since he just used a paper ballot or mail-in ballot. Anyway, I don't know how that meshes with the elections being run by the states, but I guess time will tell on that one.
I would think that forget executive orders. What's the great quote I saw? Something along the lines of, see if I can find it. That Congress is now just a social media outlet, and the executive branch is running everything. And that's been true for quite a while. The institution has abandoned itself. Congress more or less doesn't exist except as a social media operation. The institute has abandoned itself. The executive branch runs the country with the judicial branch throwing down random speed bumps because the legislative branch has no role it wishes to perform.
Well, I think
that sums it up pretty well, don't you?
You think the Speaker of the House, if he got his nose out of Trump's ass, maybe the Congress would do something.
Well,
he doesn't want to do anything. He loves it the way it is. He's been told to stand down.
The House does?
The House, what have they done? They won't do anything.
Well, they've tried to push legislation straight through, and then they actually were right very rightfully. Killed that bill that got thrown at him at the end of last week from the Senate that the Senate did a hit and run on, and they did that and then went home to go on vacation. That particular bill had funding for ICE, except for no funding for anybody in ICE to get paid, whether that's Border Patrol or the ICE agents. So effectively, they shut it down. And why the Republicans went along with that, I don't know, other than they probably didn't read the bill. They just wanted to get the hell out of town.
Well, right now,
if nobody can work there, go ahead. But we haven't shut down Border Patrol. That's not been an issue. But now all of a sudden it is, so that we can go back to the way it was, start waving people into the country.
The bottom line is nobody wants 92,000 ICE agents. Nobody wants the ICE budget to be bigger than the Marine Corps budget, which I think it now is. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants people running around in masks. Nobody wants people running around without body cams and acting like police. And they're not trained for it. It's out of hand. And I don't know how Congress.
Well, they've conceded on the body cams and said, they'll do that. They're conceded.
Okay. Does that make it right?
I frankly, I don't think they should concede. I think they should just wear them. That's me, but, I'm crazy.
Operation Midway Blitz, according to the Trib yesterday, 3,800 detained, 2,500 are deported, most with no criminal record. Where are they deporting these people? Back to where they came from, or just wherever they feel like?
Well, they have to go back. They have to go back to the country of origin.
I think a lot of them weren't, but I don't know. We'll see if this piles out. Anyway, the Cubs. Another crummy day today they're going to be playing, but they're not hitting much. I think they got a pretty good team. I think they're going to have a good team, but so far they haven't really shown it. But, I guess it's early.
Well, they're 2-3. The big thing about getting started on any season is just don't bury yourself.
Yeah. I don't you do have questions, not that they should ask us, but you do wonder why you would take a warm weather team that's only coming to town once, and you give them their series in March. What if a couple of these games got rained out with the Angels? How do you make them up?
Rain them back.
Hey, what?
The Angels may be coming back to Chicago to play the White Sox. So, if there's only
possible.
One,
I didn't think of that. That's possible.
If there's only one to make up, that might be able to that might be worked into the schedule. Or they could be coming to play the Brewers or, even the Tigers. It's not hard to make that kind of stuff happen. So I would be less worried about that and more worried just about, why not take advantage of the fact that it is a warm weather team. Play your games there. If you want to get your opening day in, cool, get it done. But that's one series, and then get the hell out, go someplace warm.
Well, it's been quite a difference between the 72 degrees the one night last night. Whether their friends and family were there last night and they were brave. I don't know about today either. I mean, it's pretty nasty. But hey,
totally uncomfortable to go to a baseball game in the cold weather. It's even worse than football because at least in football you sort of anticipate it. And you've played different flavors of baseball, softball. It sucks in the cold weather. It sucks to be a player.
Well, at least in softball, there's something happening like every little bit. I mean, pretty much people hit the ball and you're moving more, plus the game only lasts an hour. But
it doesn't drag on. But on the other hand, you go play in Chicago where you play 16-inch with no glove, and you go ahead, play first base.
Yeah.
See what that does to your hand.
Yeah, it's a rough... did you see the... I saw it last night. Somebody showed it to me, but I don't get Facebook, so I didn't... Facebook's another issue because of the FINRA rules. If I was on Facebook, everything I said on there would be considered like a communication to customer or something, which is really crazy. But anyway, you see the camera shot on the parents of the kid who lobbed that ball in for a UConn?
I don't think I did.
It's spectacular. The mom turns away at something about, let's just say, if you're a lip reader, you would add a bleeped it out. She's like, oh, bleep and bleep. when the kid made the basket.
I'd be considering quitting basketball because that's never going to get better than it is right now.
Yeah, but I didn't watch UConn that much, but is that kid any good? Is he a starter or is he a bench guy?
Oh, he's a freshman. He's a good player.
Okay. So it wasn't just some kid in because somebody got fouled out and won one in. He's a real player.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's cool. I think UConn was probably the one team that didn't belong there, and they ended up winning. I was actually at a, unfortunately, a, what do you call them? Nobody has a wake or funeral anymore. I don't get that, but that's...
Celebration of life?
I guess, yeah. This place on 95th Street, and at the game, man, when I saw it at halftime, it was 15 points. I never even checked it again. So I didn't even watch the second half, and then it was 19, right?
I wasn't watching either, and then I toggled over when they, I toggle over every once in a while, and I had the Cubs on, actually, and so I would toggle over every once in a while and just see, still, Duke's still got a big lead, and then when they cut it down to 7 or 8 or something like that, then I stuck with it. So I did get to see, you know, the lion's share of the comeback and the winning shot, which was just, you know, freaking amazing. I heard an interesting observation about Duke, and I think it was Mike DeCourcy on the radio a couple days ago, and he said, you know, Duke has since, oh my gosh, like 2018, 27, probably 2016 or 15, because that's when Notre Dame played them when they had Tyus Jones, they haven't had a real point guard since then. They've had guards that are not by nature point guards, so they become point guards by designation, but it's not really their skill set. They haven't recruited them, and they haven't, and they tend to run their offense through power forwards who are really outstanding players. You know, Zion Williamson, Cooper Flagg, and then now Boozer. So, you know, they're running their offense through those guys, and they're very talented, but they're not really point guards either. So when they have teams make a run at them, like this is 2 years in a row where they've blown big leads, they don't have that one guy who can calm down, organize, and get everybody back where they belong. And the other thing about running it through these very talented power forwards is they're all freshmen because they're going to the NBA the next year. So, you know, they're kind of left high and dry, and that may be something they really need to look at in how they run their program.
Well, I mean, even today's world where you pay everybody, you can't pay. It is interesting, Kevin. That, you know, as you know, Carl and I are always jousting about who we should arrest first, right? What the bottom line is, you know, and I don't know why some people have been directed, because you listen to people, I guess, that somehow, you know, a certain group of people that don't obey the law are the ones that are screwing us all over. Yet you look around you and everybody's kind of doing the same thing. Does anybody, I mean, you gave the very good explanation last week of these NIL contracts and how they're supposed to be reviewed and stuff. Does anybody check to see if the guy really made the five State Farm commercial? Does anybody even care?
I don't know. I know they actually do go over them for approval when they get submitted. They don't just rubber stamp them, because that's been a problem for some schools where they put something in for approval and it didn't get approved. And now they've made a promise to somebody they recruited and they have to find another way to deliver on it. Doesn't mean they can't find another way to deliver on it, because they can.
So if... Well, how low does this go, I guess, is my question. What if, say, if, you know, if we wanted to hold a seminar, you know, we never really held seminars, but say we did. We used to go to seminars, and I used to do a lot of speaking, but if we decided to have a seminar in the Hilton about money management or something, and I grabbed two guys off the Notre Dame team and paid them 10 grand a piece to show up and sign autographs, how... Does that 10 grand get approved, or is there money? Is there a limit on it? I mean, is it a 50 grand, or does it have to get approved? I mean, I can't
provide
believe.
Provide grand worth of value, they will approve it. If it's just paying them 10 grand for something that should be 500 bucks, it won't get approved.
Okay, but I mean, who knows how much them signing autographs at our seminar is worth? I mean, if it's 5 million, I get it, but if it's 10 grand, one of these morons is going to say it should be 9 or 11. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, if it brings in 100 paying customers, it might well be worth that kind of money.
It seems like there's an awful lot of people getting an awful lot of money. And how many people in the review process? 10?
Well, I'm sure they bottleneck through it, yeah. Which is a different problem, because if you're trying to get all this approved so that you can get started with some of these people, and you can't even submit it until the guy's actually signed on with you. So,
so I can't just write that check. You know, Pete's Pizza no longer can have the offensive line come over for free pizzas or something on a Wednesday night. Is it down that low?
It probably is, but that kind of stuff's just going to sail through, so that's not going to be a problem.
So, I mean, when you look at all the amount of people that are playing ball, men and women, there's thousands of these things. I can't believe these guys review them all or police them all. Did he really show up at Pete's Pizza or not? How the hell do they know? They don't care.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, they have a system in place that makes sense in terms of the status quo of them being student athletes and all these being third party arrangements and trying to have some governance on it. So it makes sense in that regard, but the whole setup in the first place doesn't make any sense. So, you know, they're employees. Just make them damn employees, and it'll be a lot easier.
Well, because they're not employees of Under Armour.
I understand that. Let them cut whatever deal they want with Under Armour. But you make them employees of the university. Don't cap what the universities can pay them. If they want to bankrupt themselves, build their basketball programs, let them.
I guess my question is, when are we gonna, economically? It's a sponsored pro team. Why don't we just say it is? I don't get that.
Yeah, just make it honest. Make it an honest system. We've been talking about that for a long time.
Well, idiots still want their money deductible, right?
They want money deductible, but they also don't want all the bother of making their athletes into employees, because there's a whole lot of crap that comes along with that to being an employer that they get to avoid right now.
Well, as you know, I'm still a fan of our alma mater, but I'm going to say the beautiful church, I don't have a problem tax deductible there. It's in the Constitution. I guess the school, the for-profit football team, just saying. I don't know that should be tax-free. I don't know that Northwestern, with their incredible operation at the hospital here, should be not be paying property taxes, and everybody else is getting... The guy who can't afford his property tax is paying God knows how much to go in to get two stitches in the emergency room at Northwestern. It seems like it's a little weird, doesn't it?
It's a nonsensical setup. It doesn't figure, and it needs to be overhauled. Needs to be fixed.
By whom, I guess, is the question.
Mm-hmm. Trump will do it.
Yeah.
Actually, we've had Congress sniffing around this. That's not necessarily who should fix it, other than to enforce. Other than if we just enforce tax law, and I think existing tax law would probably cover everything if you just said, here's how we're interpreting what not-for-profit means now. And, if they were to do that, I think that would sort of fix things, wouldn't it?
Well, there are two.
It fixed some stuff. It wouldn't fix everything.
I think you probably know this, but I'm not so sure most of the listeners know. It's the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And I'm not so sure if the New York Stock Exchange, I think most of them were probably set up the same way. But they were set up under Delaware law, much the same as a country club in terms of ownership. And CBOE was a not-for-profit institution. Okay, so by definition, they're not there to make a profit. Okay, but if they did, they had to pay taxes, which is different from a non-profit, which if you make a bunch of dough, you don't pay taxes. And I don't know what the distinction there necessarily is. So the CBOE, if all of a sudden there was a busier year and they actually did pay taxes on a lot, when I say a lot, they wanted, at my day on the board there, they wanted $100 million in working capital. So if they ever had a problem, needed to buy something, a computer, generator on the roof, whatever it was, they had the money to do it. So they actually had to pay taxes on the $100 million that we were working our way up to as working capital, just cash in the bank. So they had to pay taxes on that. But what they would do if they were having a year that would say the income was, or the revenue was above budget, and we're trying to make, say, $10 million that year, and it looked like we're going to make 12, what they would do is just not charge the members any fees for, like, December, and essentially rebate it that way back, so you didn't have a quote profit. Now the members, of course, by not having to pay that extra fee, if they made money, made a little more, and they had to pay a little more on their end, right? So the government got their money anyway. They just didn't get it from the CBOE. So in other words, if you were a trader and you were going to make $500,000 and you saved, $10,000 on fees the last month, then you're going to make 510, right, that you got to pay on. So somebody's paying somewhere, assuming you made dough, right? So the government got their money someplace. It wasn't like Northwestern or Notre Dame or anything like that. So that was a not-for-profit, as a distinguished from a non-profit. Isn't this bizarre, Kevin, all these definitions? But I mean that was just not for profit in name only. They weren't tax free. So you wonder if you could do something like that with some of these institutions. But I don't know what you would do. But what do you think if when they talk about private equity getting involved? What does that mean? I mean if BlackRock can't invest in the University of Notre Dame, I don't think. What do they do? Separate out the athletic program?
Yeah, they would have to reincorporate then.
Well, then I don't see how that could be tax-free to you.
Nope.
Crazy stuff. What the?
I guess you get to some point where, you know, the business model says it's worth it.
Yeah. What's the college you work? They're just a regular set up as just a regular college, and so that's kind of a
public school.
It's just okay, but they're you're part of the Indiana group or no? Not really.
What Indiana group?
Well, I mean, are you
part of Indiana University? No.
But are you funded at all by the state? I guess is my question.
Yeah, we're funded. We are funded by the state.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a whole funding model. I'm guessing Russell and Larissa know how it works too.
I think the funding. That's what I mean. I guess we're not going to go through it today, but I think the funding model is different for University of Indiana versus it is for Purdue versus it is for you guys. I mean, I don't know. There's probably different nuances, I would guess.
There probably are, but when it gets right down to it, the state cares about three things. One is what's your headcount. That doesn't get you a lot. It gets you something. But what's your headcount? And then do your students keep coming back? Do they start advancing towards a degree? Because that's called persistence, and so there's also funding for persistence, and then the final is for completions. So if people, you know, do your students actually come in and get degrees or get credentials from you, and so that's a big piece of the funding model too. And so your funding as a school, as a public school in the state of Indiana, isn't just, hey, we really, really want this much this year. It is going to be based on how you're performing as an academic institution.
Okay. Hey, you mentioned and I think a lot of people are convinced that Congress isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. But I guess, Kevin, back in, if you could imagine a Congress that, quote, does work, how exactly, if somebody decides, say there's a problem with, schools becoming professional sports or something. Did an individual congressman on a certain committee that somehow handles something like that? In other words, in a Congress that runs properly, where does the impetus come from? It doesn't always just come from the speaker and everybody else votes the way that he says to vote. It used to come more from individual people and committees. I don't know. I'm asking. I mean, who would dream something up to I don't know, if somebody decided to say the patent laws is now affect the drug industry, pretty much suck. I mean, you and I think would agree that I don't know what the solution is, but they pretty much suck. Where in our idea of a perfect world where the three pieces of government work together, who decides I'm going to fix this? Is it one party? Is it the speaker? Is it one committee? Or the committee chair says, hey, this is in our ballpark. Let's start working on it and pops a bill out of commandment. I don't even know. It's been so long.
Didn't you watch that video when you were a kid? It was probably on a slide projector or one of those. What were those things that had the tape, the rolls of projection that taught you how a bill was made?
Well, I know that every guy or lady in Congress gets to submit a bill, correct?
Right, and then it goes to committee, and committee's going to review it. Committee is either going to say, yeah, we want this to advance, or we don't. And if they advance it, then it's going to start winding its way, for instance, to the House, might get onto the floor for debate and consideration, and then it might get as far as a vote, or it might not. It just depends on the interest that people have in that.
Well, I get the feeling
that was why, you know, if you go back to when Paul Ryan was still in the Senate, he wasn't even a Senate leader at that point, but he proposed a rather comprehensive, different approach to health care, but a comprehensive health care bill way back then, but he couldn't get it out of committee because his party didn't control the Congress, therefore they didn't control the committee. So it was dead on arrival in the committee, but that's, you know, it all got published. It, you know, I know I've shared it with you at some point.
Well, but what if you and I come up with one?
It, by the way, that bill also covered Social Security.
Well, if you and I, in today's world, it seems like if we popped one out that the drug group didn't like, we're not going anywhere. I mean, how much does the drug group tell that head of the committee or the other guys in the committee, you let this out of committee, there goes your donation?
I'm sure they do.
Well, that's a problem.
So, I mean, in the most benign way, they've convinced everybody that their status quo is a really, really good way to do things. We just need to tweak it a little bit.
Well, I get it. It comes down to the ancient argument: which came first, the chicken or the egg? Does the fact that Congress isn't doing stuff, is it because somehow or another the people we were going to elect last time or this time, there's nothing they can do? I mean, we've heard Carl talk a lot about his buddy couldn't wait to get out of there. And this year there's, I think, a record amount, I'm sure there's Democrats leaving too, 38 Republican representatives want out. It's a dead-end job. They don't do anything. They're not asked to do anything. They want out. I'm sure there's probably 30 Democrats that feel the same way that want out. Well, clearly there's a problem someplace, somewhere, where people who want to do something can't, and people are bitching at people because nobody does anything. I mean, I don't know. There seems like this is a tangled web that's been weaved here. And I don't know the answer. I'm just trying to see if you know more than me, basically.
I doubt it.
Well, I mean, I can see that it's a mess, but I also think that there's an awful lot of people that basically bust their ass to get this job. And then 2 years later, they can't wait to get out of there. So, I mean, they can't all be assholes. I mean, some people must want to go there and do something. When they get there, what can they do other than vote what their side tells you to vote? I mean, what is an individual person asked to do? If you get there and you're a PhD in economics, does anybody ask you to come up with anything? I don't think they want you to say a word, do they? I don't get it. I don't get it at all. I mean, before we just rag on people, maybe we should understand why they're not doing something. Just saying, you know.
Well, yeah, power gets concentrated amongst leadership, and as people climb through the ranks, and you know, I think when it comes to keeping everybody in lockstep, I think the Democrats are way better at it than the Republicans are.
Yeah, they seem to all have their issues when they have control.
Yeah, they do. I'm not saying this is a derogatory comment about the Democrats either. I just think they're really good at what they do. I don't necessarily like what they do. I don't often like what they do, but I think they're good at it. I think they're good at keeping their caucus under control, and they don't have a lot of people breaking ranks on them.
Well, I mean, you got a president that threatens them all now. He doesn't even need to come from the speaker. But you know, it's just, I mean, you wonder why it's not working. I mean, this morning I was hearing this thing about the administration is demanding from Penn a list of all the Jewish employees at the university. And somehow a judge, I don't know where they found this idiot judge, said, yeah, they get the right to ask that in a country that supposedly religion is not a thing. And then Penn says, we don't even ask people who are employees here what their religion is. How can we give you the list? So this one's bouncing around in court. Another waste of time. But I, you know, this,
I'm not familiar with that story. What's
evidently, I don't know what there's their
purpose for it.
Well, you know, because they're going after all these universities that Trump doesn't like by saying they didn't protect the Jewish people enough. So he wants a list of everybody and that works there that's Jewish, and they want to interview them to see if they were targets of any anti-Semitism.
Okay, all right, I get it.
So I mean, but I don't think most places. I mean, PTI never kept a list of anybody's religion that worked here. Why would we?
I don't think anybody's ever asked me.
Yeah, I just, you know, this whole thing about anti-Semitism. I don't. I'm having sign of an issue with this, Kevin, and it's as you know, I'm about the most live and let live person there is, I think. I think I love America. I haven't really liked any of the last five presidents. I don't think that makes me anti-American. I just think they didn't do the job as well as I wanted them to do it. Let's put it that way. It doesn't make me bad. It makes me think that my country deserves perfection, which I know you're never going to get. But this constant drive that if somehow you're against everything that Netanyahu does makes you anti-Semitic, to me, is horrifying. I mean, I can see. I would never give anybody any grief for their religion or whatever they are, but when you talk about Jewish people, by the way, who I absolutely love because they love their religion, they're all smart, blah blah blah. The idea that AIPAC is such a massive, you know, I'll use the term contributor. I'll be nice in every one of these elections. I find horrifying, Kevin. I honestly do. I absolutely do. Now, it doesn't mean, according to the Supreme Court, you can't do that stuff. That doesn't make me anti-Semitic. But I don't want AIPAC, under another name, spending $600,000 to say bad stuff about somebody on TV. I don't want them doing that. I don't want Pritzker doing it. I don't want some company doing it. Does that make me anti-Semitic, anti-democratic? I just think it's wrong. Am I right on this or not? I mean, do I have a right to feel this way or not?
Anti-Semitic, but that isn't what was happening on university.
But I'm saying the idea that
people were being singled out and not allowed to go into class, were getting harassed, all kinds of things like that. So that's, you know, that's what was going on. Whether that, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, I can't say whether the administration is going about this the right way or not, because I'm not following the story, but. You know, it people aren't being labeled anti-Semitic because of, you know, because they don't support Netanyahu.
I think they are.
That's not even close to what was happening.
Well, I mean, I think people sort of have to understand people a little bit, and there's a lot of bad people in this world, right? I'm going to say that if China attacks Taiwan and maybe drops an aircraft carrier or two along the way, that there are going to be people in the world that hurl an insult at a Chinese person walking down the street. It wouldn't be me. I know the person here is American. It wouldn't be me. But the idea that somebody does that is something I guess I would expect. I mean, that's just the way people are. For God's sake, we put the Japanese in internment camps the last time we had a war, right? I mean, we have people in this country that are amazingly racist, that don't like people and are looking for a chance to yell at somebody whenever they want. What it might be 2% of our population, might be 10, but it's there, right? Now, I don't know I mean, I don't know who's...
Yes.
But, I mean, I guess I don't... If somebody is that big of an ass and runs onto DePaul campus and does that and yells at a couple people he thinks are Jewish, they might not even be Jewish, I don't exactly know how that's DePaul's fault. I mean, I don't... What are they supposed to do?
It's only DePaul's fault, because as exactly what you just described is not DePaul, not anything that DePaul could stop. It's only DePaul's fault when you have people organizing, lining up, blocking entrances to building, and singling out people that they either believe are Jewish or they know to be Jewish, and preventing them from getting through the line.
Well, that's a problem.
And then DePaul is not mobilizing its security to do something about it, and they're just knowingly letting it happen, then we got a problem with DePaul, don't we?
Well, I mean, we weren't at Notre Dame when they had all the war demonstrations. What if 10,000 students wanted to do something? How many people do they have in university security? 10?
Okay.
I mean, I guess, you know, because we're casting all these stones all over the place, I just like to think through, okay, what is somebody supposed to do? I mean, I don't think DePaul liked the fact that that was happening. I don't know. I guess it's real easy to criticize after, right? I guess is my point here somehow. Kind of a bad point, but
it was in real time, so
yeah, it was. It all happens. Well, you know, but to go back now and try and go after Penn, what is that going to accomplish? They don't even know who's Jewish they were asked the question.
I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I'm not familiar with the case, and I'm not familiar with what they're investigating, so I'm not going to comment on it.
Well, all right, so how much money is everybody getting from being in the... I almost kind of was happy UConn won, because I think the Big East needs a little dough. So the conference gives them more money for winning that game, right?
Yeah, although Patino said he's got some donors that call him up and say, what do you need? You know, I'll write the check. So I don't know that the entire conference is hurting.
Well, I mean, they're hurting in terms of NCAA money from being in the tournament. I mean, how many games has the Big Ten played in, for God's sake? What is it, $200,000 a game or more now?
Oh, it's way more. Yeah, the only thing I'll say is the Big Ten's got to split it up about 35 ways or some, however many people are in the conference nowadays.
It's soon to be 60 or 70. But somebody was telling me last night what the hell school are... Utah's now in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
And BYU is where?
They're Pac-12.
Okay, and then Utah State is in the new
reconstituted Pac-12. Yeah.
Okay. All the states are in there, right? Washington State, Oregon State, Utah State. What is the difference between?
Yeah, they picked up a bunch of teams that were in the. Like the Western Athletic Conference or something like that, one of those conferences that's been around for a long time.
Speaking of which, is there, I mean, Lewis or Russell probably know that, but is there a difference in funding or in between the University of Michigan and Michigan State?
Well, good morning.
Hey. Good morning.
I actually don't know if there's how much of a difference between Michigan and Michigan State for funding. I don't know how the state of Michigan divides up their funding between the two state universities.
Well, were they both land-grant schools to start with? In Illinois and Illinois State are both land-grant schools, and Indiana State both were, right?
I believe so.
Okay.
My guess is that, and it's strictly a guess, and I should know this because I live in Michigan, but I don't. Is that they both have the same funding model, whatever that is, for the state of Michigan. And I don't know, I'm actually, even though I live in Michigan, I'm familiar with Indiana's funding model because I work for a school in Indiana. So, you know, what can I say? They're probably similar, but there may be some program-specific stuff that comes into play as well. So, for instance, there may be additional funding for Michigan State's Ag School, which is really good. There may be funding for, I don't know what program would be a specialty at Michigan. There may be law school funding at Michigan, for example. Michigan State has a really good school of supply chain management. So there may be some things that the state designates as important programs for the economic development of the state, and they may have some additional funding that comes into play.
Well, there's a huge difference in the tuition. So is that made up for? I mean, I think Michigan is way more expensive than Michigan State, I think. I mean, Illinois is a lot more expensive than Illinois State. I mean, is that made up by the state or not?
You just have to pay extra to make people hate you.
Oh, all right. Well, I guess.
That was funny.
Well, I mean, is Purdue considered part of the Indiana group, Larissa?
Purdue's a state school, so it
should be. All right. Because, I mean, I know you can go to, like, Western Illinois a whole lot cheaper than you go to University of Illinois, especially if you're coming from out of state. So, I guess you would think the cost would be almost the same. Maybe it isn't. I don't know how that all that works. But
the schools also have their independent governance. So the state of Indiana schools, their governance would include things like, you know, IU Indianapolis and, you know, Indiana University includes those, IU South Bend, you know, all those various ones, where Purdue doesn't have as many branches, but they also do. But I do remember that there was some leeway to have individual policies and as it related to tuition, because I remember when Mitch Daniels was in charge, that he had a tuition freeze for a tuition lock, and the day you enrolled, your tuition was cast. They couldn't raise it on anybody who was enrolled. They could raise it on next year's class and what they're going to pay all the way through, but you had a four-year guarantee of tuition when he was in charge.
What what is the tuition? I used to, Larissa, I found this site, and now I think they need me to pay for it to get in there or something. You could probably get in there. It's a, if you just Google tuition at all the schools, there still is this site. I think it's American Colleges or somebody runs it. Every single school, going back to like 2000, maybe even before, all their tuitions, in-state, non-state, room and board, all that stuff was listed. Absolutely tremendous site. So I followed that for a while, and then I couldn't find it again. But it seems like there's times at which tuition really runs up, and then it stays fairly steady for several years. I mean, when Kevin and I graduated, it was real low, and then it really spun up like two or three years after, maybe after my brother graduated. This is in Notre Dame. And then it really spun up, and then it kind of leveled off for a while, and then it spun up again. Are we in a... The last few years, are we in a spin-up stage, or are we pretty stable the last few years?
Well, it's funny you should bring this up. If you're familiar with Milton Friedman, he wrote a great essay on what really drives the increase in tuition prices. And he makes the argument that every time the government sends out stimulus checks, and this, he was basing this off really the GI Bill as the initial study, saying that when the government sent out all that money so that people could go and get their degree, the university said, oh, you have extra money, we're going to raise tuition. And then every time this rounds of stimulus for extra revenue or extra money from the government to individuals for education, then you would see tuition rates go up. So be surprised.
Well, notice how Kevin, you notice how nice Larissa is? She said, they have more money, we should raise tuition. She didn't say, they have more money, we really need that money, not them.
Right. It's very much, okay, you now have access to better lending, we can now raise tuition because you should have more money to pay a higher tuition. And what are you, to some extent, the end user is kind of trapped. Because if you want a higher, if you want the degree, you're going to pay up for it. Even if it's at a not as expensive or reputable school, it's still a significant amount of money to go and get your degree.
I mean, if you're really clever, you can cut that way down, but then you lose the, I'm going to say, college experience. I mean, you could go where Kevin goes, is for 2 years, and probably you probably could live at home, work on the side, and go to school for 2 years instead of four, and academically get to the right place, or maybe even better, right, Kevin? I mean, you can get there. You go to Purdue as a junior, right? And that, and yeah. But I don't know that you don't get your 4 years of whatever else you're supposed to get at college being away for 4 years, right?
Yeah, fun.
And it's interesting, the transfer system. So I'm fairly familiar with the transfer system in the state of Illinois. If you get your accredited associate's degree, a lot of universities have a deal where they waive the first 2 years. And so a lot of students who use that model, go to community college and then transfer in, will be able to essentially knock off the first 2 years of tuition for their 4-year degree However, not all universities are required to allow them. So, for example, Purdue doesn't really have a lot of transfer students. We don't necessarily take a lot of students who come from Ivy Tech. Now, when I was at IUPUI before the Great Split, we did see quite a few students transfer in from Ivy Tech.
Okay, because, I mean, you're right. They're, it's, you know what's sort of interesting, kind of on the same topic, is Notre Dame had a huge ROTC program for a small school. Yet I didn't see anybody there in the GI Bill. Did you, Kevin? Which is, you'd think would be, you know.
No, but I wouldn't necessarily have noticed.
They would be older than us. I didn't see anybody older than us.
Well, true.
But I mean, what you're talking about, Larissa, is I think the
school, but like Larissa said, you know, transfers, you know, still getting admitted is going to be competitive. And so you're going to see a lot of Ivy Tech students for a lot of reasons. But some of it because admissions is competitive and Purdue's got transfer applications from all kinds of schools all over the country. You know, only so many from Ivy Tech are going to get in. So that's going to be a factor right off the bat. But we're going to populate IU South Bend, IU Fort Wayne, or Purdue Fort Wayne. Oh my goodness, we can go down the list. IU Indianapolis and, you know, all the public schools, Ball State, you know, all of those. And plus, for the same reason that a lot of students choose to go to Ivy Tech, they're going to stay home, they're going to hold down a job and get a college degree. In a lot of those cases, they're going to continue to stay home or maybe move out on their own, but they're still going to work and do everything, and so they're going to do it locally, and they tend to stay local. If you went to Ivy Tech in Fort Wayne, you're probably, you know, there's a good chance you're going to go finish up your four-year degree in Fort Wayne.
Well, College of DuPage allegedly, I don't think allegedly, I don't know if they still do it, but it's very difficult to get in University of Illinois Champaign Engineering. So I think what DuPage tried to do or has done successfully is they, like, mirror image the first 2 years with, like, the exact same curriculum they do in Champaign. So anybody who drops out of the program, they essentially have ready and willing people to pile right in. And I think that's really worked well for them. I don't know if they do the same thing in, like, accounting and stuff or finance, which is also hard to get in. And IU. Do you try and do that, Kevin?
Absolutely. There is a, you know, if we're going to have transfer credits, for instance, in business, there are some very specific requirements for the courses. And just to give you one crazy example, the business law, because I've taught business law, there is a comprehensive final that is prescribed by the state. So you got to do this. Your students have to pass this if you expect a credit to transfer. So there's a lot of negotiation about what's in there. There's also specific articulation agreements, some with the other public schools in certain programs and some with other private schools. You know, like we have a supply chain management articulation agreement with Evansville, and we have one with Franklin University and so on. So, you know, it just is going to vary from school to school as to what the process is. But for the state schools, especially in business, there's a lot of prescribed content in the classes. There is a Commission on Higher Education that handles all this stuff.
Well, you're faculty.
I'd like to jump in, if that's okay. At Benedictine University, we work with College of DuPage, and we established 2+2 degrees, but we also established a 3+1 degree. So you did 3 years at College of DuPage, and then you transferred in for your final year at Benedictine University. And to Kevin's point, this was all prescribed. These classes were very similar, lockstep. The sequencing was the same, and we worked very diligently to make that happen. I'm also on a committee at Purdue reviewing the AP credits. There's a new class being developed for financial planning, and we're evaluating, and again, this gets back to Kevin's description of the prescribe what's in the class, because if it's going to be accepted statewide, that means all of us need to be in agreement of what's going to be in the class and what's acceptable for that class to be waived at our respective universities.
I ask this for kind of for a reason. Well, I hope we'll ask everything for a reason, but who teaches the third year? Because our Tuesday and Friday producer, young Ricky, a terrific kid, he's going to junior college on the Northwest side. Kevin, you probably don't name it. It's not DuPage, but there's one up there. And they had some program where, would you say, which one?
Was it Wright?
I'm not sure, but they were going to
be Wright, all the way out to Oakton.
Well, they were going to do, like you're talking about, this is a 3+1, but the third year, the professors were actually going to come from DePaul and Loyola and someplace, and they were going to teach the third year there. Is it?
Wow.
And I don't know how.
That was not the case at College of DuPage.
Because, you're talking about the Dow DuPage teachers were going to keep doing the teaching. You weren't sending people
Correct.
Over there. Okay.
Some of that's going to depend on what the credentialing standards are for courses. So I have very specific credentialing standards on who can teach for me and who can't. And if you generally a master's in the discipline at our college will do it. That will be fine. But now when you start talking out of field masters, then we are looking at how much industry experience do you have? What kind of certifications do you have? And so on, and that all comes in. And there are also some conditions where, we can get somebody with a bachelor's degree can teach for us under certain circumstances. And in that case, that may be where you get the hang up on credentialing, because in the example with Ricky that you used, it may be that they're saying, well, you have to have somebody who meets our college's credentialing standards, and therefore we will send that person to you. We'll do a teacher on loan, basically, is how it works. I mean, we have to do the same thing with the high schools who are taking dual credit classes. We have to make sure that they credential to teach at Ivy Tech, even if they're going to teach as a high school instructor, because you have to meet that standard. And then the other thing, and Larissa described this, is then what's in the course content. One of the ways that we address that is that there are specific learning objectives. And again, if you're going to transfer credit for a course, then it has to be blessed by the places where you will transfer. But the learning objectives, then, I have a lot of leeway to take a statewide course and teach it the way I want to. But I darn well better meet every learning objective that's specified, and that can be audited. And if I don't, then I ain't doing it right, and that's a problem.
Larissa, a quick story. When I was in high school, Marist started something like that where they had a couple teachers come from, I think it was Thornton Junior College at the time, that became Olive Harvey, whoever the hell Olive Harvey was. So the guy came and taught two classes, right? So in Notre Dame, the one time I ever saw a counselor, I said to the guy, I did these couple classes in high school that were college classes. Do I get any credit for those? The guy goes, you get all the credit in the world. Good job. He goes, but you're not getting out of two courses here, but good job. There was my credit. And I figured, I don't need to go see any more counselors. This one didn't work out so well. So that was the end of my counseling. But listen, we were talking
about... You bring up a really great point. Different universities have different standards for what they will allow to transfer in. I have heard rumors that Purdue is very stingy on what they allowed to be transferred in, so that if you have a degree from Purdue, you are taking Purdue classes. And again, at different universities, such as Benedictine, where we allowed you to have 3 full years at another institution, they were not nearly as strict or rigid about these things. And that also makes a challenge for going to a community college and trying to transfer in some of these credits.
What if you're a basketball or football player and you come through the portal?
So you can come to the portal. We'll gladly take you. Doesn't mean you're going to graduate.
Well, there you go.
Doesn't mean we're going to necessarily get all your credits transferred. What? I have a current student right now who's, I think, was at Purdue for 1 year and is going through the portal again. I think this might be his third or fourth university that he's looking to transfer for. You can imagine that most of his credits, it's a bangled mesh of different credits at different universities. It's going to take the student quite some time to be able to graduate with the degree.
So he's got another 2 years in him.
At least.
That's wild. Scholar
app. I don't blame him for wanting to get paid and to play a sport.
Well, I guess. I mean, that's a... We'll get... It just... I don't have a problem with it either. My only issue is, let's call it what it is. It's a professional league, and the schools that want in should be in. And I don't know if you heard, you weren't on last week, there was a gentleman, the first round of the NCAAs, the guy was talking, he's basically, the budget is $10 million if you want to have a real basketball team right now. He said, if you're not willing to come up with that, you might as well forget it. You might have a guys for a year or two, and then you're going to lose them, which makes me wonder why, you know, if it was me, I know Kevin disagrees with this, and he's probably half right, and I'm probably half right, but I'd almost shut down the recruiting process. Why should I go do all that work and, you know, have my guys flying around in private jets, eating shrimp and so forth, and flying these kids around if I'm only going to lose them after a year? I mean, what's the point of that? There's a lot of... But anyway, basically, you know, I don't know if you ever heard the man, Rick Tellender, wrote a book, it has to be 40 years ago, about where he thought college sports was going. And he predicted you're going to have some universities that essentially have a university-sponsored professional team where nobody cares if the guy goes to school or not. He maybe does or he doesn't. And the rest of the schools are going to drop back to, quote, the old model. And boy, he seems to be sort of spot on. I don't think... Especially in basketball, because all these schools play basketball. It's not as much. I don't know that the. How many schools do you think are going to come up with $10 million, Kevin? I mean, 50? 60? 80 maybe in basketball? But how many schools play basketball? Several hundred, for God's sake. The rest are just going to drop back to.
350 in Division I.
Really?
Yeah.
So how many do you think are going to pony up $10 million? I mean, plus there's not enough kids to go around. I mean, you start paying somebody like me $1 million, you don't want to be doing that. I couldn't even jump. So how many kids are actually worth that? I mean, you're really falling out. And I think the Big East, or Marquette evidently, is making moves. My buddy Bill is getting letters from all over the place, and now the alumni is starting to come back and say, well, that's what it takes. What do we got to do? Which brings in all the questions we were talking about earlier, Larissa, in terms of, is it tax deductible? Who is it? Is it a corporation? Does the group that gives the money have to make some money so they can at least survive, or are they going to pony up, hit people up for money every single year, which I don't think is a strong model. I think if they're going to be the marketing arm for some kid and get the Nike sponsor for them for $1 million, they might keep 100,000 of it. Why wouldn't they? They have to be ongoing, because I don't think you can go back to Larissa or Kevin or me every year and say we need another $100,000. At some point, you have to be self-sustaining, I would think, if you're one of these sponsoring groups. I mean, it could go anywhere, but I just... It's funny how many people are in denial. Like, these guys, like, it's like the way it was, and still people think that way. I don't get it. What do you think it's going to land? I mean, where does... I mean, you're not speaking for... I thought Indiana in football would be one of the schools that opted out. Boy, was I wrong there. They're in over their heels, right?
I mean, yes, they are.
I think Northwestern probably will not be in all in. Again, I could be wrong there again. They could throw more money at it than Indiana this year. But I think you can sort of name the schools. I don't know if Boston College is ready to do it. Kevin, do you?
Boston College has decided just to take conference money and not compete. They did that a long time ago.
Okay.
Except in hockey.
No, but that's different. Half the guys on their team have already been drafted, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's another whole protocol and how that all works. But no, it seems like it. On one hand, Larissa, to me, it's fascinating from the economic side. It's like the birth of a whole new industry, right?
Oh, it is. And I think you're right that it isn't a sustainable model. Hitting up donors every single year for these large amounts. Right now, things are going well in the economy. Again, if, especially if you prescribe to the K-shaped economy, you're going to be hitting up donors on the top side of the K, and they have disposable income to be able to write those checks. What happens if there's an economic downturn? What happens to the industry then?
Well, I think, you know, you and I are always, one of these days, well, who knows, maybe today we'll argue that point. One of the ladies who...
Boy, I'm going to leave it to the two of you to argue, because I got to get going.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much, buddy.
Bye, Kevin.
As of now, not doing a show on Friday, but because of the labor numbers, we might rethink that. I'll let you know.
All right.
Okay, but the... one of the ladies is on CNBC... anyway, because she had an argument with my buddy Dr. J in the air one day. I've never had a big warm feeling for her. But anyway, she's one of these people, I won't give a name, that thinks that she can tell you how you're... The great comment yesterday with Russ is, the consumer is doing way better than they think they are. And I'm sitting there going, what did you just say? what moronic statement is that? Oh, by the way, you think you're broke, but you're really not. Trust me. Okay, then. Like, okay then. But one, I wanted to lob at you today because I know you're all over like the CPI stuff, and you and I were jousting about that a few weeks ago.
Silly, because if you're looking at your paycheck and you're thinking, I only have $82 in my checking account, and somebody's telling me that I'm doing better than I thought I was?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Well, essentially, if you look at the government numbers, things look fine.
We've talked about that before. You know, we've looked at it. But the individuals, again, if you only have $82 in your checking account, you're not thinking, woohoo, I feel great.
You might be able to take the family of four to breakfast, maybe.
Maybe.
But, you know, it's one of the things that I actually probably didn't see it because it was a Tribune thing, but Maria Pappas, and, you know, I'm all for her because she came out with this, a good Greek lady, came out that for the last 30 years, she says that the increase in Illinois taxes, property taxes, have been double the rate of inflation that the government puts out for 30 years, which is what when you and I were jousting a few weeks ago, what did I say? I went back 25 years. She went back 30. It's been double the whole way.
Not disagreeing. Illinois taxes are incredible.
Well, I mean, I bet a lot of other states are too, in some ways. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, if you go back at, it's a while, I should do this again, Larissa, but although it was a pain in the ass to do with some, I think it was a Saturday morning where it was snowing, so I couldn't go anywhere. I went through, I looked at the CPI from, I must have done this in 2020, from 2000 to 2020, or maybe it was 21, the CPI said that everything was up, a dollar in 2000 was worth, I think, two something, or 181 or something in 2020. And I picked three areas. I picked taxes in Illinois, property taxes, which I thought was the, since it's basically half goes to education, I used that, and again, you know, it's not an A paper, but I used that as a proxy for not higher education, but the rest of education. And they were up 2.85%. So 285%, which is like another 100% over the CPI. You know what the scary part was? I looked at higher education, the same number, 285. And then I looked like real sloppy on healthcare. I looked at the price that a firm like PTI or Purdue pays for your healthcare. It was up the exact same number, almost 300% versus the 180. All three of those things were the exact number. I mean, I would never have guessed that. But three major things that people pay, by the way, property taxes, are not even on the CPI, right? So they're not even included. And I don't know what percentage higher education and stuff is, but clearly healthcare is, you know, they claim it's 6% of everybody's basket. It's a hell of a lot more than that, right? I mean, I'm going to say, well, for you, let's make a guess. They're paying let's say you're making $150 a year. Well, if it's costing $2,500 a month to insure you and your family, or $3,000, that's a hell of a lot more than 6%, right? What they have on the sheet.
And that doesn't include how much you're actually paying on a month-to-month basis for all the things your kids need. So that's just the insurance.
Yeah.
And then you have to pay, when you go to the doctor, you pay your deductible, right? And once you hit the deductible, you still are on the hook for, 20% of the bill? So it's not, even if you're just looking at the cost of insurance, there's a lot more to it. And the person who manages that portion of the finances, it's a lot of money.
Well, I think I was trying to be, because I was going to, you know, on your side, not that you're taking the other side, I was trying to be nice. Because
it's a lot of money.
Well, because the reason why, I mean, obviously, PTI had employees in 2020 and in 2000. So as time went by, I think when we originally started buying people insurance in 1991, I think it covered everything, or damn near everything. I don't know if anybody had a deductible, but as time went by, we would buy a really nice plan for everybody. But then if somebody wanted extra, they ended up having some deductible, like you're saying, and it kept going up every year, right? If somebody wanted, like, dental for the family, they might have to pay $20 a month for that. So there were like a bunch of add-ons. So, yeah, I mean, for me to compare the gross number in 2000 to 2020, your insurance covered a lot more in 2000 and 2020. There's no question about that, was what you're saying. So I was being nice. I just took the gross number. It's actually worse than that.
Much, much worse than that. And again, as somebody who has kids, they have needs. It's shocking how quickly some of those things go. And we have a deductible, I want to say it's $6,000, but it might have gone up to $7,000. So I know at the beginning of every year that my healthcare costs are going to be much larger until we have that deductible. And then it will slow down a bit, but I know it's going to be $6,000 or $7,000 out of pocket up front before we even really start to reap the benefits of healthcare, of the insurance itself.
Well, plus these guys, I don't think you're as, as thinking how crooked they are as I am. But I'll tell you why. When I say this kind of stuff, it's always because it happened to me, right? My brother set up. Remember those? I suppose they still have the health savings plans.
The HSA.
Yeah. Yes. Were you ever in one of those?
Yeah.
Well, there were two kinds. One is you had to use the money up by the end of the year. Then there was another kind where it actually became like another IRA, where it stayed there forever. So right. We had that kind, and this was very early on. It was only like one bank that did it. It was some bank in Highland Park, and you could only put your money in the bank. You couldn't put it in the S&P or anything like that. So my deductible was, I poured $5,000 in a year, right? So the thing gets up to where it's like worth like $15,000. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm doing better here than I am in my IRA, right? And I hadn't been sick in forever. So all of a sudden, this one year, I end up with, I don't know what I did, if I messed up a thing. Somehow or another, three different body parts, I think had to do with softball. I had to go to a specialist and then get an MRI. And it turned out that there was no surgery or anything. I was okay all three times. Every time, the specialist plus the MRI, this is at Northwestern, was like $4,900. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. So in one year, my $15,000 was gone, and the insurance company never paid a dime. I had like $40 left. They were that close. They knew just what the deductible was, and that's what they charged me.
right?
It's scary, the interplay between these guys and these insurance companies.
I think you're spot on saying that it's intentional. They know how much it is. And that's why when you think about health insurance and health care costs, there are different rates that they can charge people. So that there's the health insurance rate. There's health insurance rates for different companies that they work with. So Blue Cross Blue Shield might get a different price than Anthem. And then there's also the price for out-of-pocket. And it's to me, that doesn't seem right. And I understand why there's contract agreements and things like that. But when you think about the fact that the hospital has the ability to charge four or five different rates for the same procedure, that doesn't seem right either.
But by the way, you don't know how right you are, because that is an absolute violation of the Clayton Act. And there's been two Supreme Court cases that confirmed that it's illegal. And yet, we've had this big discussion this week, and we're going to break here in a couple minutes, but we can kind of tee, we got some time. We can tee this one up is when, I want you to get you into a constitutional challenge here, but, I mean, we're the first country, according to Andrew and Wayne, they have essentially, where the judicial branch is essentially a co-equal partner to the executive and legislative branch, which sets our constitution apart from like British and French and these other people. I don't know the full part of it because I'm not a lawyer, but bottom line, but still, I think the weakness of our constitution is the executive branch. And I read this from a lot of people. They said, but the founding fathers gave the executive branch a lot of power because they knew the president was going to be George Washington. And bottom line is, there's been a lot of guys that have been president since him that aren't George Washington, one of whom happens to be sitting there right now, in my opinion. But that the Supreme Court really doesn't have any right of any way to enforce this stuff. So hospitals are doing exactly what they've been told not to do for 20 years. They do it every day. And there's no enforcement of it whatsoever. And I don't know what they're supposed to do, go to Congress or go to the White House and say, hey, look what these guys are doing. But you're right. You're not supposed to charge. I mean, what if the lovely Larissa walked into the store to buy a hamburger for the kids, and you said, how much the hamburger? And the guy said, how much you got? I mean, that's essentially what they're doing, right?
It is essentially what they're doing.
And that's not exactly the way anybody else does business, do they? We don't. By the way,
no.
How much are your commissions? I don't know. How much money you got?
Right.
I can't imagine that conversation. But that's why there was you're very familiar with Indiana, by the way, obviously. Do you know where Columbus, Indiana is?
I do not.
Well, just south of Indy. One of our first clients was from Columbus, Indiana. Boy, talk about it. You would have loved him at this guy, but he's long dead. But he ended up being a huge developer out in Phoenix. He was one of our first huge clients, right? So, plus, he owned three or four islands up in the Bay of the Islands in Lake Huron.
Nice.
Yeah, where the family would go up there before there was a bridge, take the ferry, spend like the summer before they had running water, and you had to boil water for the dishes and all the whole bit. And they would stay up there. They loved it. And Audrey and I actually went up there and spent a few days. It was really something. We've got some pictures someday. If I ever see you and Russell, Audrey dragged those out. You wouldn't believe the pictures of these.
Well,
of what. Anyway, the dude was in Columbus. He had some sort of a business where there were 200-300 people working for him. And this was back, you know, it has to be 40 years ago. And he said they self-insured. And what they did was they said, okay, we got a big policy from like Lloyd's or somebody for anything crazy. I mean, the crazy stuff is heart attacks are no big deal, really. Pretty much people die or they don't. But anybody having a child that needs a lot of care after birth, that's probably your biggest expense. Cancer is a big expense, that kind of thing. But anyway, said you insure against that. And everybody else, they just went to the doctor and they just paid the bill. He said they saved so much money the first year. But then all of a sudden, it got to where if you went to the hospital for an appendectomy, it was four times as much as Blue Cross was paying. It stopped all that. But back in those days, every firm could essentially self-insure the smaller stuff and not make money at it, but do better than insurance or as well, as long as you had, you know, a deductible for the bigger stuff that nobody can cover if it happens, right? But then all of a sudden, there's no way a firm could do that now when you're paying four times as much as a insurance company. I mean, they're essentially right. Selling you their price. They're not selling you insurance, scary as that is. I mean, you're right.
But they're selling you the discount that they're going to be able to get.
Yeah.
With their relationship with the hospital.
Well, we got 2 minutes here before break. Let me just see how conspiratorial the lovely Larissa is. When you get a bill from the hospital for $10,000 and they want you to pay $2,000, that's your deductible. Do you think they're giving you the $10,000 is the list price, or do you think that's the same number that the insurance people are paying? Do you think there's two bills there or one?
I believe that the insurance company makes an agreement with the hospital, and this happens through, because I've spoken to medical providers, and they've told me that this is what they do. And there's agreement saying that we're going to pay, the most we're going to pay for this type of operation is this amount of money. And so the hospital, not only, they know how much it's going to be because they have written contracts with the insurance company, but that's why some hospitals don't take certain types of insurance. So if you can make $100 off of one type of procedure or something that you need done, whether it's just a visit, or if the most you can make is $40 based on the contracts that you have, you might choose not to accept the insurance that only pays you $40. So as a result, that's why there's different, you see these signs that say we only accept such and such insurance, and that's because of those contracts.
Well, what's going to break
it? And I don't think that's a conspiracy. That's just how they operate their business.
Well, it ought to be a conspiracy. Hey, what do you say we go to break? We'll come back and I'll give you a quick story about pre-Obamacare, which you probably never really...
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I mean, remember pre-Obama.
It was crazy. Anyway, S&P futures up 45, NASDAQ futures up 229. We're second day in a row. We've got the president speaking tonight. But 2 days, we seem to think there's going to be relief in the Middle East, at least as of this moment. Although I don't know how it's going to be defined. Nobody seems to know. But anyway, there's some idea that this is going to be ending rather soon. That would be very nice. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
here, right now. Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allender on the board. S&P futures up 42. NASDAQ futures up 218. And this right here is kind of since we came in. It's a big add-on to yesterday's massive rally. Started up high and then really jolted the morning as kind of the rumor got out that Trump was going to talk tonight. And evidently people are suspecting an end to this war, but I don't know what an end would even look like, but I guess we're going to... European stocks rebound strongly as Trump signals timescale for end of Iran war. Anyway, DAX up 604, 2.7%. Now, these guys have all been down. FTSE up 200, 2%. CAC round up 156, 2%. So we got at least 2% rally across the board there. Over in Asia, and South Korea's KOSPI leads rebound in Asia markets as Trump says Iran war can end in weeks. For some reason, my computer is gagging here on these guys. There we go. Nikkei up 2,600. It's 5%. Again, they were down almost to 50,000. Hang Seng up 505, 2%. Shanghai up 56, 1.5. Oil, it's not down as much as you would expect. Oil prices seesaw around $100 in volatile trading after Trump war exit comments. And why don't you throw us traffic, weather, sports, and I'll come back to this because my machine is gagging on all these stuff I have going. Oh, there we go. Oil's down 241, 98, 97, so it's still pretty high. Brent's the one that was at 116. Now it's down to 102. So it's come down a lot. RBOB's down to 314. Still, not like the 205 it was when this all started, but it's come down some. Bonds, and the interest rates had been going up every day. Now they are not. 4.3 in the 10-year. The Bund is 2.98, so they're back under 3%. So some progress there as well. Gold up $93, 47.41. Had a big rally yesterday. Silver's only up 2 cents, 74.94, but had a big rally yesterday as well. Foreign exchange. Dollar lower. That's one of the reasons why the gold stuff is up. So we're up to 116, the euro is. It was 115.5. These half and 1% moves in currencies, and we'll talk to Larissa about this. It's a big deal if you're doing any international work. British pound, 133.03. It was down to 132 and change. Crypto, up $636, 68,439 on the Bitcoin. Yeah, Andrew, what do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is Wednesday, April 1st. It is 7:33 here in Chicago. And got a good mix of losses, rain, and heavy traffic. So a good day here. Sports, Suns lose to the Magic 111 to 115. And over in baseball, the Sox lost to the Marlins 2-9. And the Cubs lost to the Angels 0-2. For Chicago weather, things are not looking much brighter. It's currently 38 degrees. We're going to have a high of 43 today. We're going to have periods of rain this morning with a lot more to follow tonight as it builds up. And the day's going to be mostly cloudy and winds will be building up as well. Over in Phoenix, they're rainy as well. Currently have 75 degrees. They're going to have a high of 86. They're going to have the occasional passing shower throughout the day. And finally, for Chicago traffic, there is an accident on the northbound side of Lakeshore Drive heading east before Monroe Street. Not heading east before Monroe Street, before East Monroe Street. Three left lanes are blocked, so expect delays up to 30 minutes over there. Other than that, the inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 23 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Coast is going to take you 48. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is going to take you 30. Dan Ryan from the 95th is going to take you 25 minutes. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 32 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Larissa, one of these days, Andrew is going to give us the sports report that Angelica gave us the one day where she says she could care less about sports. She's from Ukraine. Nice lady with a terrific accent. Beautiful girl, not that I noticed. And so one day she goes, Bulls lose to Pistons. Who cares? All they do is lose. And she goes, what's a Piston anyway? And she says, I go, Angelica, it's a piston, not a Piston. All right, what's a piston? What's a part of a car or an engine? Why would anybody name a team that? Well, it's from Detroit, the Motor City. Ah, who cares? All they do is lose. That was the sports
report. Oh, that's funny.
And you know what? She was kind of spot on.
Was it back in like 1990,
1991? Well, not long ago. It was probably, I'm going to say 10 years ago. It was before COVID.
Okay.
All they do is lose.
I do have a sports question for you.
Okay.
I had heard an urban legend that on April Fool's Day that Walter Payton tried to play a prank on the city of Chicago by saying he was leaving the Chicago Bears. Is this true?
You know what? I'll bet our tomorrow's producer, Jimmy, will know that because he actually worked up in Lake Forest at the Bears place when Payton was there. Payton was a massive prankster.
That's what I heard. I've read books about him, and I just thought that would be hysterical. Like, he came on the news and made an announcement that he was leaving, and I heard that the fans reacted very poorly to this prank. Well, they did not enjoy his humor here.
Jimmy said it, when he was supposed to be at practice, he'd leave practice and he'd go in and he'd tell the girl at the switchboard to leave, and he'd sit down and he'd act like he was the switchboard operator.
Oh,
well,
no.
Hello, Chicago Bears. This is Walter Payton. Can I help you? Dick is around looking for him. Where the hell is that Payton? He'd be out there.
Yeah.
Oh, he was a carry. He was, I guess, a really fun guy. You know, it was a shame. Obviously, he died young. I mean,
right.
His kid's terrific. Jared Payton. He does a lot of TV here now. Real smart kid. You know, whatever. Just a shame we kind of lose some good ones early, don't we?
We do.
Anyway, just a real quick, before the Obamacare, how these hospitals kind of used to work, my girlfriend, one of her drum corps girlfriends, her husband, he's retired now, but he was the director of procurement, and I won't give the name of the place, but it was the biggest hospital in the state outside of Chicago, right? And he said, we're talking, you know, a long time ago, in the 90s, before Obamacare, he said, the whole thing is kind of breaking down. He says the hospitals really sort of self-insure within themselves, where they have like 20 or 25% of like the Cadillac patients, where, you know, somebody like you with really good policy goes in, you have a baby, you walk out the door with a box of diapers at like $400 or something, that kind of stuff, where they just charge you a list and the insurance companies say, oh, we'll just pay it. And then there were insurance companies under that had the deals like you're talking about. Then under that, there's Medicare, which only paid a certain amount. Then there's Medicaid, that only gave you $100 a day at the time, no matter if you did brain surgery, you did nothing. You know, again, it's going...
Wow.
And then there were individual people that paid or couldn't pay. You couldn't turn anybody away, right? So if you did something for somebody, maybe they paid, maybe they didn't. He said, but it was all kind of structured on the fact that you basically screwed the people up top to pay for all the rest of the people. But he said, but insurance companies were getting less and less willing to do that, and that whole thing was falling apart. And that was one of the impetuses for the Obamacare thing. And the idea was, and, you know, makes perfect sense, I think, in an economics lab, that if everybody had insurance and you didn't have anybody in there who didn't pay anything, that the people up top would actually do better because theirs would be cheaper because they're now essentially covering these people. So that was the original theory, that by the time you got done without addressing any costs, and by the time you got done with all the other garbage and the combinations of insurance companies while this was going on, you ended up with kind of a mishmash, even though at the start of it, it sort of made sense. And now we're left with what we got, basically. But that's kind of where we came from. I'm sure you knew that, but the industry used to be sort of like self-smoothing for the expenses in a hospital, and then they weren't able to do that anymore. And so that's when the government kind of stepped in, first with Hillary's plan that nobody liked. Of course, I never read that one, and then all of a sudden, then Obama came in and kind of jammed this one through. But is that your read of the history of this as well, or you got a better version?
You know, I don't know enough about it to make a comment one way, either way. I do remember the big change, or at least the big change that came out of it that I thought was important was this idea of the pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if memory serves correct, that Obamacare removed the notion of a pre-existing condition, so that you could have continuous health care as opposed to these poor people who would be stuck in a job and fighting for their jobs if they had a condition and they knew that they wouldn't be covered at another job because of this loophole with these pre-existing conditions. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, very much so. And it's kind of a... You know, there's a trap there. What do they call it?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, but what a lot of things that, you know, I'll say used to happen. And when I started trading, I probably shouldn't tell you when that was, but when I started trading, I just I saved up $10,000. I put it in an account. Second time I had a sort of trading floor, I had a badge on. A little badge, not a big badge. I could only play trade 12 stocks or 20 stocks. But my clearing firm picked up my hospitalization, Marissa. And I didn't give them dime one. I didn't even make a trade yet. They picked up, and if I hired, and I it wasn't long before I hired a guy to be my clerk, who had a family, guess how much my insurance was for him? This is 1981. Guess how much I paid? $75.
Wow.
Yeah, can you imagine? As opposed to like $3,000 now. $75. Wow. He had a family. And but young people paid the same amount really as older people. The idea being, okay, it's fine. We were young and strong, right? We didn't have nobody went to the doctor unless you broke a finger playing softball or something. I mean, where did we go? 2 decades? Well, you didn't because you're having kids. But if you're a guy and you're healthy, when did you go see a doctor? Never, right? Unless you hurt yourself playing something. So the idea was, okay, we're paying more than we have to now. That's why it's insurance, but it's okay. When we get older, the young people would be paying for us. Well, that didn't work out that way, did it?
It did not.
So it's I do want to hitch up with so much current events here, but the current events are, we've had this big run back yesterday in the market. Okay, now since we just give a little bit of a brief, we started this war, I'll say. We did, I think. But you know, whatever. But before we debate that or not, we started this thing. We're expending stuff. It's costing, you know, $2 billion a day by most estimates, maybe $1.5 billion, something like that. We were kind of broke to start with in terms of debt. We have some of our allies that have given us like a lot of dough, maybe meaning Japan, now have paid a lot more money for oil, so in any case, they're probably worse off than they were when it started. So we have this going on, and now hopefully the president's going to say it's going to be kind of over some sort of an agreement. I don't even know who they're talking to. It kind of troubles me, Larissa, that Pakistan is all of a sudden the mediator. I don't know if I trust those. Whatever. A lot of crazy stuff is happening. But let's just focus on the fact that in 4 weeks, it's going to come to some kind of an end, hopefully. And we can pull back and stop paying the $2 billion a day and whatever. Who knows if we're occupying stuff or not or whatever. But we're up to $39 trillion now in debt. We've taken other countries now are even more in debt. The winners here seem to be Russia. So I don't know what that's going to mean in terms of the Ukraine stuff. Now they have more money to throw at Ukraine. Do we have to throw more money at that or Europe? But yesterday, as soon as the market ran up, it must have had 10 people, Larissa, that you know want you to send them their money, and the market's always going to go up. And they're all saying, we're going to like go back to normal, where the market is just going to go up every day. And this was just a blip, just another blip where nobody should have sold, and we're going to go back to, quote, normal. I want, since I really respect your view of the world, what is your idea of the normal we're going to drop back into? What are they talking about? What is the new normal, I guess, is the question.
You know, I think this kind of goes back to this idea that the statement that the consumer is doing better than they think they are. I don't know what the new normal is, because if the new normal is that I'm living paycheck to paycheck with a credit card debt and I'm one car repair away from going under, that's not a normal I want.
It sort of is the normal, though, isn't it, for most people?
It is the normal.
Yeah.
That's what has me concerned. Like, what is this new normal and why would we want to celebrate that? Again, if you're on the top half of the K, I get it. It's not bad. But I think a lot of the, even on the top half of the K, asset prices are going up, but their daily cash flow isn't necessarily as glamorous or as great as one might hope, right?
Yep.
They're still able to function if they own stocks, so stock values have gone up. That's great, but that's all basically on paper, right? If you don't sell your home and your home has gone off by 50%, you still don't have that cash flow. So, again, I don't know what the new normal would be, and we're talking about what it's looked like for the last 2-3 years, or if we're talking about like the during the 2010s, where we had a nice increasing slow steady growth. But again, that was recovery from the 2008 crash. So I'm not entirely sure what the new normal would be, and I'm concerned about how that would be defined. And I'm also concerned that I don't know that a lot, because of the way the numbers are aggregated from both the top and the bottom, that anybody would be experiencing this theoretical good new normal.
Well, if I went on one of these national shows and tried to do something regarding the debt and where it's going and interest rates and where I think they might be going, and if I were to do some sort of a sketch of what you just said, I really do believe since 2000, and surely since 2007, 2008, 80-85% of the population has been in a recession where the cost of living has gone up faster than their earnings. And I think I could easily prove that to anybody's, you know, where you'd give me an A and not an F. I mean, I think I could easily prove that for regular people. I mean, the tax thing here in Illinois, just another one of those things. I don't know how, but there's some end to this, and I don't know where the end is. I know where the end was in 1929. It was a pretty horrible spot when 80% of the population was in depression, when the other 20% were buying Duesenbergs, right? I don't want to see us go through that again. Yet I don't see how at some point here this long-term rate isn't 8 or 9%. And I know what happens when that happens because I lived through it last time. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm that old. I can't even imagine what this stock market, what this wealth bubble looks like if we're talking 10% long-term rates. I mean, what do housing prices look like, for God's sake? I mean...
I don't necessarily think it's going to be something like 1929 or 1987. I personally believe it's going to be more like 2000, where we had these mini crises, so to speak. And we saw a decline in the stock market of 78% from its high to its low. And granted, that took about a year and a half. It took 18 months. It wasn't a singular event that completely obliterated the market. And you do have 9/11 in there. You have the dot-com bubble in there. You have a lot of things that have happened in that 18-month time period. But the market dropped 78%. It took 16 years to fully recover from that.
Well, you're talking about the Qs, the yes. NASDAQ, S&P, yes. S&P was not that dramatic, but the Qs, yes.
Yes, thank you. And
well, some of the stocks. I'm gonna let you finish here, but remember the stocks back then that were the Magnificent Six or Five that we have now. But they were over 50% of the NASDAQ, just like the big ones are now. Can you remember who they were?
I cannot remember who they were.
Yeah, when I rattle them off, you'll remember. It was Oracle.
Oh, sure.
It was Cisco.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft. I think Dell.
Yep.
Who were the other two? Micro, Cisco, Dell. There was one more in there somewhere. And the only one, I think to this day, that it's higher than it was in 2000 is Microsoft. The rest of them never
Isn't
came
back. Isn't that scary?
I give a lecture. My buddy, Dr. J, good guy, always was giving speeches. Well, we're in New York, and I'm going to see a client or two, so I go with him. We love traveling together. John was always fun. And he says, hey, by the way, I'm supposed to give this speech tomorrow morning in Brooklyn. And I'm double booked. Hey, how about covering for me? There you go. That's the stuff you do for John. It's worth it because he's a great friend. First of all, I've never been to Brooklyn, so I get out my subway map. There I am down at 5:15 at the subway platform. I end up in Brooklyn, walk up, go in a hotel, and there's this room full of people. And the guy starts the seminar. Hey, how is everybody? They wouldn't even say hello to him. So the guy the guy talks for like 10 minutes. He looks at me, and I'm just a guest speaker. He goes, "They're all yours," and walks out. There's like 60 people there, and one guy goes, "You're the guy who's supposed to teach us repair strategies." I'm like, okay, I can do that. I mean, I don't know if you know where those are, but if you don't, I'll go through it. And I said, "Well, what kind of stocks are we talking about?" The guy goes, "Well, I got a bunch of Cisco." Well, Cisco had gone from 65 at the high to 6. And I go, I'm not so sure I got a recovery strategy for that one. I might have to give you like a succession of, to be brief, repair strategy. If you buy a stock at 100 and it goes down to 90, if you can buy 190 call, sell 295 calls for, say, even money, if the stock goes back to 95, you made $5 back on the stock and you made $5 on the option piece. So you're break even now at 95 instead of 100. That's why it's called a repair strategy. But obviously, if it keeps going past 95, you've locked yourself in to just breaking even, which when it's at 90 is okay, but when it goes back, you know what? And these guys, it was a brutal room. I said, "How many people own Cisco stock?" Larissa, probably five-sixths of the people raised their hand, and I'm going, you got to be kidding me. But I mean, the stock, I remember at the time when the stock was 60-something, it was 11 or 12 times revenue it was trading. Not PE, but revenue. And that's why when I started, I mean, you've probably heard me say, when I see these big stocks now, the big ones, they can't really double. I mean, Google and Microsoft, those kinds of people, Google maybe not so bad, but they were 11 or 12 times revenue. They were as big, NVIDIA's there. They were as I won't say overpriced, but priced the same as the five were in 2000. I mean, the stuff is incredibly high. And I don't I mean compare, but I guess I'm asking you, as a nation, how we're going to wiggle out of this. But how does Japan, I didn't send this to you the other day, but I should have. It was a lady talking about the price of oil for Japan really was like $130 a barrel because their currency had gone down in terms of dollars. And how Japan, just so you know, our national debt is $39 trillion. Our GDP is $31. So we're, 25% over GDP, right? Which is, we've never been there before, ever. Maybe the last part of World War II, but I don't even think it was then. Japan, on the other hand, is their national debt is $11 trillion. Their GDP is $4.4 trillion. So their debt is like three times their GDP. And they're probably, well, in a lot of ways, they're our biggest and best ally, because don't they have $1.2 trillion over here in U.S. bonds? I mean, if we do weird stuff that kind of breaks these guys, I mean, can you imagine if the last two auctions have been lousy? What happens if these guys don't show up for an auction, Larissa? Does anybody even think about this stuff?
I'm not entirely sure that they do think about it, but yeah, that would be a very difficult position for us to be in.
And, you know, and we, so that's why I ask you, like, if all of a sudden, and I sincerely hope this is, because people stop dying, if all of a sudden, you know, Trump declares victory, okay, they're never going to be able to produce a uranium bomb for like a really long time. We're pulling out, and the other guys say, okay, well, since you're pulling out, even though we don't like it so much, the strait will be open, and we won't do any nuclear stuff going forward, and let's all be buddies or something. If that happens, I think you and I are two of the happiest people there are, because nobody, people are stopping dying. If that happens, I don't know that the world we pile back into is all that good here. I mean, in terms of the money, still, the debt is still there, right? I mean, how are we going to do with that? What are we going to do about that?
I'm not entirely sure of how we're going to address some of those things, especially if we're also struggling with how are we going to stimulate the economy to get it up and running. Because if we're looking at raising interest rates here, what is that going to do to, again, the bottom part of the K? And if we're looking at then trying to stimulate that with a stimulus package, we're going to have even more in debt. So I'm not, there could be a compounding impact on some of these decisions.
I would agree. I just sort of, the, I don't know if you've been listening to when, on the last few weeks that Hal's been on, and he's really been on a, you know, kind of a white horse talking about the banking industry and how one of the reasons for the K that he brings up is even though we, you know, Jerome Powell's leaving, I never thought much of the dude because he didn't. He never seemed to look outside the limousine to me. But when he talks about interest rates going down, I did a quick study a while ago, Larissa, between, what was it, whenever the 2007 and 2020, when the interest rates went from whatever to like 1%, or we got down to 0.5%, the credit card interest actually went up. So the idea of interest rates going down never made it to the people you and I care about. So if they go out, and Hal is at a, he's written a bunch of stuff now, and he's actually given a couple of papers on how the change in the banking industry, where they only want to give, the big banks only want to give loans to certain big people. It's too much work to do the small people. That the people that Trump and Obama and everybody talks about, the middle, lower class, middle class, that are the big small businesses, that are the big job creators, which I think you and I would agree on, they're totally not being served by the banking industry. I mean, the big people can go out and borrow it, you know, maybe 3-4% even now, maybe 5, but they're not. I mean, if you and I want another plumbing truck, it's going to be 10, right? If we can get one, and we probably got to sign over our house, right? That he thinks that a lot of the K is because of how the banking industry does not service essentially small businesses. What do you think of that?
From what we've just discussed, I don't disagree with them. I haven't looked into the banking industry and how they do treat the bottom half of the K, but on the surface from our discussion, it sounds reasonable. Again, I just haven't done any research in it.
Yeah, I mean, seems like there's some research there to do, but I think most, I can't imagine, you know, walking in for a bank for a construction loan if I'm a guy putting houses together. Can you? I mean, boy, I better be somebody I've done business with.
No, again, from what you're saying, it seems like I would agree with you. I don't see how any of this is incorrect. I just don't know.
What are your?
But it sounds reasonable.
Last couple of questions. Your students have to be asking you stuff off topic. What are they asking?
Most of the conversation right now in the last week or two has been about the NCAA tournament, which sadly.
Well, you know, it is a nice diversion, and you guys almost got there, but I have a feeling these teams. I think UConn might be a little bit of a pretender, but the other three teams, I don't know who's better. They all look like they're really good, don't they?
They do. I'm hoping for Michigan, but after we lost to Arizona, it was pretty hard.
Yeah.
It was pretty hard on campus. So that's what we've been talking about that's totally off topic.
Well, but making it that far is pretty darn good.
It is pretty good.
I think Kevin...
Yeah, being in the Elite Eight is pretty amazing.
Well, Kevin thinks his Arizona team, he's had them from the get-go, and he watches more of the stuff than I do, for sure. He thinks they're pretty special. He thinks they might be... I don't know where they got everybody out of California Penal or something like in Major League, but those guys are all pretty good. And in Michigan, the thing about Illinois is the freshmen.
Illinois looks good.
You know, because by now you're almost not a freshman anymore after you've played in all these kind of games, huh? Those kids get better every game.
Well, absolutely, and these are, I don't know, they're not as green a freshman as when we were students, right? I mean, as an 18-year-old kid, you're a kid, but now the athletes definitely look much more mature, much more controlled, a very different look to the game itself.
Well, when I was there, freshmen couldn't play until my sophomore year. But our freshman that year was Adrian Dantley, and he would have fit right in today. He was 6'4", 220, and... Well, if you pushed him, he wouldn't move. I mean, he was a big kid. Yeah, some of these guys are kind of ahead of their time, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, well, the kid from, he's only a freshman, the guy who sunk the basket for UConn, right?
Yep.
Did you see the picture of his parents when the shot went in?
I didn't see the picture of his parents.
All right, his mom, let's just say, if you were a lip reader, you had to make the kids close their eyes. She's like, what? But she would, they all of a sudden, what a great shot of her and the dad. I mean, that was pretty neat. Anyway, I loved having you back. I miss you when you're not here. What are you guys doing? Easter, big plans, or just, I'm sure, is there school Friday? Probably not.
No school on Friday, so we'll be at church celebrating Easter.
Well, good for you. Put in a good word for all of us, you know.
Okay.
You got to put in a good word for Russell. He needs it.
Sure.
Anyway, take care of yourself. Good to have you. SP Futures.
Thank you.
We're only up 22 now. NASDAQ's only up 140, so we've come back a little bit. But still up. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.